Welcome to another podcast from www.michaelgrinder.com. Today's podcast are excerpts from a recent conversation Michael Grinder had with Gary Phillips from www.artofsafety.net. Gary and Michael are talking about power, influence, and the use of verbal and nonverbal communication. Let's join in.
What philosophy or set of values informs your work? What's the Reader's Digest version of that?
What comes to my mind is that I favor nonverbals over verbal. I favor, when appropriate, to use influence instead of power. And the difference between the influence and the power would be influence is when you are nonverbal versus verbal. Influence would be when you manage through looking at the sign, the expectations, the norms, as opposed to eye contact. Influence would be when you manage and you manage from a distance as opposed to close. It would also be that the length of time is short and brief, and we make a distinction between management and discipline. Management is a nickel and dime and do pattern interruption. Let's get back to why we're here and let's get our work done. And discipline is when there's a violation. It's against policy, values, ethics, and the purpose of the discipline is to remove or isolate the person, or at least try to minimize their influence on others, as opposed to management, where you're trying to keep a person a member of the group. Very, very different outcomes.
The time is short?
Much briefer. So that's why if you go verbal, you end up saying full sentences and you get caught and you breathe high. Whereas if you just do a nonverbal or point to the norm, you end up having it much shorter, much quicker. And the person receiving a management through some object or written directions or paper on their desk, their sensation that they report is that they feel like they're okay as a human being, but their behavior is inappropriate. So you're not attacking their identity, you're attacking their external. So the term that we use is manage the behavior, not the person. Another guiding principle, if that's appropriate, guiding principle.
Yes, it is.
Is the idea of person versus position. And so when you are doing any kind of management, the more you understand if the person resists, it may have nothing to do with you in particular. So try not to personalize resistance, try to professionalize resistance. Another template we use is what we call a model of professional development, where what we're doing is we're focusing in on, if I'm learning something brand new, I have to first know that verbal level. At the same time, since nonverbals are more important than the verbal, as soon as I can learn what to say, the language, the jargon, protocol, and on a verbal level, then I go to the nonverbal, how do you deliver? So the verbal level is the what, and the nonverbal level is the how. And we have a whole developmental scheme of what nonverbals are, what you do with your eyes, your voice and body and breathing. The third level of your professional development is, since you know how to deliver something called nonverbals, when you deliver it becomes even more important. So the timing involved. And that's where you enter the artistic realm of communication. Most models inadvertently of professional development will have you come back to the seminar to learn again what you missed the first time. So it's guilt-oriented. Whereas if you add that fourth realm of, you may not have permission to do all the fine skills you have, it makes a lot more sense to you to keep your sanity. The other thing that it does is it allows someone who's very good at work as a communicator to come home and realize, I don't have permission to do this at home. And so it's an absence of understanding that fourth realm, permission and receptivity, you start feeling like, you run the risk of falling into the trap of, I must be a hypocrite because I can do this at work, but I can't do it at home. I can do it with these people, I can't do it with my spouse. I can do it with these people, I can't do it with my mom, my dad, or my children.
You describe this as a fourth stage or step almost, or I'm concerned people might perceive it that way, and yet it sounds like that's the first thing you should have or identify.
It's the first thing I start with when I teach other people, because it gives you a pathway to understand where am I in my development. But it's also a wonderful template when you are not just with yourself, but you're coaching, mentoring someone else, you're supervising someone else. Where do you start? What's your first level of intervention? And your first level of intervention is, do they know their content? If they don't know their content, why focus on delivery? Because when you're learning your content, you're internally focused and you're not aware of outside people, group dynamics, how receptive are they. So the faster you get your content down, the more you have it memorized, the more you can then focus on how you deliver it.
Mm-hmm.
Two examples of that are important. One is in our great area of Portland, Oregon, where I live. We have this wonderful chiropractic college. We have people from all over the West Coast coming, including a lot of Canadians. And what happens is they tend to like our climate here. It is wet, but it is very green. And so they like our climate and they settle here. What happens is then you have an abundance of chiropractic practitioners. Who's going to make a living? They all have about the same knowledge base. So it's how do you deliver it? It's the bedside manner. It's the customer relations. It's the focus on satisfying the client. That's the difference that makes a difference after you know your content.
Mm-hmm. Do I not need to think about permission until I've got the what's, the how's, and the when's in order?
It's four levels that are always present, but whether you're aware of their presence is what you're asking. And the answer to that, it's a little bit like when we were teenagers and we're learning how to drive a car. The first thing we noticed was what was in front of us. We didn't notice the rear view mirrors. And at some point you're driving along and you get good enough to notice what's in front of you, that you start seeing this thing that is coming towards you, that you are shocked and you pull back. And what happens is you realize it's actually not coming towards me. It's in front of me, but it is a rear view mirror of what's behind me. So you only become aware of that which you are ready to take on.
Mm-hmm.
And if your mind can't filter out at the time what's called extraneous stimuli,
mm-hmm.
you can't function. So when you drive a car and you get very good, your priority is safety first in front of you, safety first behind you. And then there's all kinds of things like keep the big picture, keep your eyes moving, defensive driving techniques. Then you can actually get into, should I ever turn on a radio?
Mm-hmm.
So you keep adding to your what you are able to take in
mm-hmm.
and be aware of as you get better at what you do. What's important, though, is a lot of people that say, I could do this job in my sleep, they are not moving to the next level of their professional development.
Okay. I think my concern is, in regard to a book reader, misinterpreting that permission described as a fourth level, and I understand that in the development stages, the others have to be developed.
Precede, yeah.
Yes, that you don't need permission. I'm worried about a misconception in that regard. If a person who is very linear and procedural takes a look at the four steps and believes that you said that permission really operates throughout the stages,
yes.
even though your professional development has to go sequentially, that permission is not needed until the end.
Right.
And I'm struggling with finding a way to describe that,
yeah.
that misconception somehow is clarified.
You need it at the beginning. You will tend to notice it
The
further you are developing.
Okay. All right.
But you need it from square one.
Thank you for that clarification.
What that fourth stage is that is constantly present, it redefines what success is.
Mm-hmm.
If you do not have that fourth stage, success is when you get what you want. When you have the four-stage concept of permission receptivity, then you redefine success as, how did I do based on the level of permission I was able to obtain?
Mm-hmm.
And so some of your finest days as a communicator is when you utterly fail with external rewards and successes. But my goodness, how brilliantly you were able to be flexible, and you tried this path and that path to try to increase your level of permission with the other person.
So, verbals versus nonverbals, preference for influence over power, being able to separate the person and the position, and professional development, as you've just described. Are there other philosophies or values that underlie the work?
A couple others that come to my mind. One is, for yourself and for other people, if you wanted to have like a 5-year plan for your professional development, what you do is you take yourself or someone else and you go, on a scale of having a high range of behavior or being very, very systematic and doing the same behaviors over and over, but consistently, figure out which do you tend to be? Wide range of behavior, but not systematic, or do you tend to be very systematic, but you have a limited range of behavior? Whichever one you are, switch and develop the other one, because to be an effective communicator, you have to have both. Mm-hmm. A wide range of behavior and then systematically employing them. Now, this ties back to the model of professional development, which is, on the nonverbal level, make sure you can do a wide range of behavior, such as making eye contact, not making eye contact, using a credible voice pattern, using an approachable voice pattern, being able to stand close, being able to stand far, approach someone from the front, approach someone almost from the side, being able to gesture close to your torso, far from your torso. As soon as you have that whole range, now you have flexibility. But flexibility without structure is just flexibility. Mm-hmm. So it's the wonderful saying that one of the Barbara Steele's, I think, said one time, the opera singer. Opera singers are just yelling in a structured way. So it's just, you have to have the range plus the systematic use.
So developing both sets us apart from the amateurs.
Right. Mm-hmm. I think the other thing that guides my work is trying to figure out what is the format or setting that the communication is taking place in. And what we did was we came up with 4 levels. One is when I'm just observing the other person and there's no interaction, what am I watching for? And so when I'm watching just an individual, I'm trying to figure out what is their beliefs and values, what is their perceptual filters, what is their operating principles, and that's basically what this interview is about. Mm-hmm. It's about my internal map of the world. If I'm watching 2 people, whether I'm one of the 2 or whether I'm just watching 2 other people, I'm trying to figure out who is likely to dominate or influence the outcome. And so I have set aside what each party's individual values and beliefs are. I'm more interested in what's going to come of the interaction between the 2. The 3rd level is when I'm trying to understand group dynamics. And so when there's 2 or more people involved, with the people present, what's going to happen next is the question. You have to look farther down, because when you do see something and you have to adjust to it, the amount of time it takes to adjust to that, you're still traveling that greater distance. You have to be able to read what's about to happen before it happens when you get into group dynamics compared to one-on-one. And then the last system that we use as your perceptual levels is system thinking. And the difference between group dynamics and system overlaps a lot, but in general you can say group dynamics are the people that are present, system are the people that are present, plus all the other members of that culture. So if it's a company, it could be a company culture. If it's a particular industry, whether it be Screenwriters Guild, movie actors, office managers, they actually have a way of thinking. And that's why for any of us that were at college and university, what you majored in became a culture. It's a way of thinking, and you filter things in and you filter things out and give priority to different things. And so the last thing I would mention as a guiding principle is the idea of group dynamics, how different that is in one-on-one communication. And group dynamics is most people are trained in one-on-one, and so you have to apply group dynamics and what you're watching for very, very differently than one-on-one.
This book project on charismatic leadership, it strikes me that in the work you've described, there's a big volume of work. If you were to write this book on your own, and to be user-friendly to a corporate audience, you wanted to chunk it down somewhat so that they would have digestible bites. And assuming that perhaps there could be a sequel, let's say advanced charisma or something of that nature, what would you put in the first level and what would you retain for later?
Good question. The later would be very difficult situations such as dysfunctional groups, crisis, anything that's connected with dysfunction such as loss of hope, an atmosphere of we never, despair, lack of synergy in terms of you don't get your energy and safety from other people, you're isolated.
Is this an analogy such as communicating when things are positive versus when you have a negative message? So when things are going fairly normatively, that would be your first approach, and that when things are negative or dysfunctional, that would be what you deal with second?
It's not so much positive and negative, it's whether it's chronic.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
If it's not chronic, then the first level has to deal with breaking bad news, volatile information. To me, that's still the number one invented pattern or recognized. In other words, it was always there, but we just noticed it. So we didn't invent anything. It's like Buckminster Fuller always said, I never invent anything. I just notice patterns that are already in existence.
Yes.
So the biggest thing that we've been able to detect and package for the corporate world is when you're breaking volatile information, do it through looking at a paper or a visual flip chart that indicates what it is, the focus is, or the bad news is, and we call that three-point communication. That is absolutely the essential part of charismatic leadership, book one. I think the other parts of book one is going to be a reproduction of the catnip, which is chapter two of Charisma, the Art of Relationship, and that is just what we call presence. And it's the ability to, number one, pause more. Book one has to be context-specific, whereas book two is more generic and generative.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more principles.
Mm-hmm. In a volume one, you would include the context-specific, imagine this, and followed by principles.
And volume two is going to be big cats, because it changes. In volume one, rule of thumb of use a third point whenever you're doing something that's negative or volatile. In the advanced book, it changes, and you say, no, with the big cats, you've got to look them right in the eye. You can't look, but you have to change yourself. Not to blink, keep your eyes open. Just you have to add other things to it. Pause more, breathe low.
I mentioned that the mirroring and matching should be part of volume one. Yet, I noticed that you underplay that, really don't address that in your work and presentations.
Right.
Tell me about that.
If we go back to the guiding principle of what is success, I'll take relationship over rapport. So if you go back to your four levels of professional development, mirroring and matching, pacing and leading are nonverbal techniques.
Mm-hmm.
When to use them is a more important question than how do you do mirroring and matching and pace and lead. And so the bigger suggestion is this. If you have permission from the other person and they're breathing fine, do not mirror and match, because you'll run the risk of losing permission.
Say that again, please.
Mirror and match, pace, lead, and that's the second level of professional development. Anything above that takes precedent over what's below it, a subcategory. Above it is perception, and above that is permission.
Mm-hmm.
If the person is doing fine, they have permission from themselves, they have permission from you, do not mirror and match, because you run the risk of actually losing permission. Because what are you doing over there? But if you don't have permission, then use mirror and match. But NLP-trained people automatically do mirror and match and go and stop it. Now, if you are going to teach mirror and match and patiently, which I think is a brilliant, brilliant concept, it's just that I think it's too universally used, go with mirror and match, pace, lead, breathing.
Mm-hmm.
Template of what are nonverbals, which is what I'm doing with my eyes, voice, body, and breathing. Mirror and imagine is usually the first three. What am I doing with my eyes, my voice, and my body? But that doesn't include the most important part, which is breathing.
Mm-hmm.
So on the cover of the Elusive Obvious, so it has that painter's palette, and it has the VAK, and then it has the brush separate, because the breathing is more important. So use mirror and match, pace, lead. So as soon as the person starts breathing well, try to start decreasing the pace lead.
Okay. You very kindly allowed me to walk with you.
If you'd like more information regarding the contents of this podcast, please contact us via the website www.michaelgrinder.com. All materials of this podcast are copyright Michael Grinder and Associates, Battleground, Washington, USA. Thank you.